The sixth office hours session for the Mises Academy online class, Basics of Economics, Introduction to the Free Market. And we'll go ahead and jump right in. Jed asks, when calculating economic profit instead of accounting profit, isn't it common to the so-called riskless interest rate? If so, and the proxy for the riskless interest rate is a U.S. Treasury bill, note, or bond, which maturity would one use? Okay, great question, Jed. Let me make sure we don't lose anybody first by let me explain some of your terminology there. But yeah, that's a great question. And also, let me just take a step back and remind everyone of the big picture. So we pointed out a couple weeks ago that there was a distinction between the way accountants would denote a profit, or what they might call net income. And so that, in terms of the accounting, it would be just to say, look at how many total, if we're talking about dollars, to say how many total dollars did we earn, or did we take in revenue and the total dollar outflow. And I'm fudging a little bit there, but that's kind of the basic idea in terms of standard accounting. And so if you spent $1 million on raw materials and hiring workers, paying the rent on the building and paying the utility bill and all that kind of stuff, and then you took in $1.1 million in revenues, well, on paper, that looks like you made a profit of $100,000 or 10% return on your money. But economically speaking, we would ask, is it really true that the investors, the owners, the shareholders in that company, you know, what did they really earn? And from the operations of that company, what was the actual economic profit? And so what you need to understand is, what's the time value of money? Because one of the other inputs into that process, if it took you a year to get that much out, is the fact that your capital, your financial capital, was tied up for that year. Another way of seeing that is, suppose I hadn't given you the time framework. What if I just told you, well, yeah, suppose it took $1 million of the shareholders' money. They had to put in the money up front to, you know, put capital into this company, buy shares of stock, and then the CEO takes $1 million and then goes out, hires workers, buys raw materials, blah, 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 makes some product, and then they sell the product for $1.1 million. Was this a good thing from the investor's point of view? Was it a profitable enterprise? And, you know, put aside ethical issues like, do they agree with the product that was being made, you know, that kind of stuff. But just say, financially speaking, was this a good thing for the investors to have done? And notice, if I don't tell you the time frame, well, you obviously can't answer the question, because if that thing turned around in 1 month, well, that's pretty good. But if it took 30 years to take their initial $1 million of investment to eke out $100,000 in the return, like, you know, over and above their initial principal, well, then that's obviously not so good. Okay, so that's partly what I'm trying to get you to see, and the fundamental economic concept that deals with the passage of time and how do we account for that, quite literally, financially, is interest. That's the economic concept that goes along with time. And as we said in the last class, one way of viewing interest rates is to view them as being exchange rates of the same currency over time, so that you can take, if you're using dollars, you can compare a dollar today to a dollar that won't accrue for 5 years, let's say, because those aren't the same thing. And so you need to know, what's the discount rate that I should use to turn future dollars into the equivalent present dollars. Because $1,000 5 years from now is not worth $1,000 today. It's worth less. I have to multiply that future $1,000 by some discount rate, which is going to be a number between 0 and 1 in order to shrink that. Okay, so what Jed is now referring to is that I said one thing that you would do is you would ask what would be the rate of return that you could have gotten just in terms of what's the market rate of interest. And then the return on your project gives you an idea of whether it actually was economically profitable. And so, for example, let's just say it was a one-year project. The investors on January 1st all put in $1 million collectively, make the product, boom, 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 and then a year later they sell all the product and liquidate all the assets of the firm and return $1.1 million to the original investors. And then that's it. And so you ask, was that a profitable venture or not? You say, well, they earned 10% on their investment in 1 year. And if the interest, the market interest rate is only 5%, well then, okay, you made more doing that than you would have made just lending the money out. And so that's the sense in which you could say they earned more on that project than just what the market pays for postponing consumption for a year. That's one way of looking at it. The market rate of interest is just how much you can get paid if you're willing to exchange present goods in exchange for future goods. So if you're willing to postpone consumption, then the payment you get is interest. That's what the pure interest return is. It's what you get just for the passage of time. And so if you earn more than that, well, that's good. But obviously if you earn less, well, then clearly you suffered a loss on the project. Even though the investors may have gotten more total dollars back when they put in, they're getting $11 back for every 10 they put in. If the market interest rate that year has been 20%, well, then obviously they made a mistake. It was a mistake to tie up their capital for a year in that firm, that their funds could have been used better elsewhere. And so the penalty they're suffering is that they are now poorer than they otherwise would have been because they have not allocated their capital the best place. In other words, the loan market, the loanable funds market, would have given them 20% interest, and instead they invested in a project that only gave a return of 10%. Okay, so that's the standard framework, and that's what we talked about a couple of weeks ago. So now that I've reminded everybody of the general context, Jed is asking a very interesting question. He's saying, you know, isn't in the financial literature, financial economics, they don't just call it the interest rate, because there's actually lots of different interest rates. And so isn't actually the baseline that they use what's called the riskless interest rate, or what's sometimes called the risk-free interest rate. So, you know, risk, then with a hyphen and the word free, to say it's free from risk interest rate. And then if so, which one do you use? Do you use the T-bill, T-note, or the T-bond? And so let me just walk through those concepts. Incidentally, as we've got more people trickling in here, as always, let me just remind you, go ahead and type in your question whenever you want. Or Jed, if you have another question that occurs, you go ahead and type it in. So the as I say, that story that I was telling before and the simple tales I've been weaving thus far in the course whenever I talk about interest rates and talk about how, you know, suppose Frugal Freddy could earn such and such in the loan market, whatever. I've been giving the impression that at any given time there is just the interest rate. And what Jed is getting at here is that actually in the real world there are different apparent market rates of interest. And so the way this is handled is in the Austrian tradition and in the standard financial economics literature is that they break it up into components. And so what you might call the gross rate of interest on a particular loan, for example, has different components in it. And one is the pure interest rate that Austrians would say is explained totally by time preference. And then on top of that, you might have a premium for changes in purchasing power. And then on top of that, you also might have what you would call a risk premium. That term risk premium is more what mainstream economists use. Mises, off the top of my head, I can't remember how. Mises talks about something comparable, but I don't think he calls it a risk premium, because in the Austrian tradition, they're really careful about the difference between a risk versus uncertainty. And so I'm pretty sure he doesn't actually use the word risk. I think he calls it the entrepreneurial component. That's what he calls it. The entrepreneurial component of the gross market rate of interest. Okay, so the idea is, let's say you're a commercial bank and you have some excess funds and you're trying to figure out what to do with them. And so a young couple comes up and they want to borrow money to buy a house. And they both have solid incomes in the home they want to buy. And they're going to put 20% down. And so the loan-to-value ratio is low. And another person comes in, he wants to borrow money because he's got this small business venture that he wants to start. He wants the bank to fund that, and it's kind of a wacky business plan. And then another possibility is they could just go buy 1 year bonds issued by the U.S. federal government. And so they could effectively be lending money to Uncle Sam for 1 year. And so the interest rate that the commercial bank would be willing to accept for those three different types of loans or investments is different. All right, that the small business owner who has the wacky idea, the bank might just say no. They might say, you got to go talk to a venture capitalist or, go talk to a hedge fund or something. That's not the kind of thing we do. That's too risky. But if they did go ahead and give the guy the loan, it would probably be at a pretty high interest rate. They would give a lower rate to the couple who wants to buy a home. They both have good jobs. And in particular, if they're willing to put 20% down on the house, because the bank knows, even if these people lose their jobs or stop paying us, we can just foreclose on the property and, we should still be able to get our money back. There's that cushion where they're only borrowing 80% of the value of the property from us. And so we as the lien holder, we have to be able to sell. So as long as that house doesn't fall more than 20% in value, we're okay as the bank having the mortgage on this place. So that's why people can get a fairly attractive interest rate, mortgage rate. It's because it's a collateralized loan with the bank. Isn't just lending you money and hoping that you're honest or that you're industrious. If for some reason you stop making the payments on your house, the bank just takes the house. Okay? And then giving money to the government, even though libertarians might think it's morally dubious, nonetheless, in terms of being of sound business practice, normally speaking, it's pretty safe, especially for shorter term loans, to lend money to a powerful government like the United States government, because ultimately they just resort to either taxing or inflation, monetary inflation, to be able to pay off their bondholders. And so, you as the person lending money are pretty sure that the U.S. federal government, especially if it's in the near future, is not going to outright default on that. They might. It's, so we shouldn't get in the habit of think it's an impossible. And it's also true that they could pay off their debts with inflated dollars that aren't worth as much. But even there, how can I put it? If you're an individual person deciding whether to make a loan of $1,000 to either a private entity or to the U.S. government, that your individual loan is not going to affect very much what the overall rate of price inflation is. right? If the U.S. government is going to be running the printing press to pay off bondholders, whether or not you give them an extra $1,000, is the grant scheme going to change that? So even if it's true that you're actually, it's a false sense of safety or security to lend money to powerful governments because they're just going to use the printing press to pay off the loans. Well, that's still, if you lend money to a private entity in that country and they pay you back, you're also getting back dollars that don't pay, that don't buy as much, if you see what I'm saying. Okay, so if it's true that collectively, if people could just agree, let's not lend money to the government because they're just going to basically rob us through the printing press when they pay it back, that may be true, but I'm saying that in terms of the individual appraisal of the situation, that's the sense in which lending to a sovereign government is actually fairly safe compared to many alternatives. Okay, again, it might be morally dubious, but the point is, when you're trying to say, do I think I'm going to get paid back on this thing? Okay, so because of that, you can see how there's different rates of interest in that setting. And so the standard or the convention that's used in the finance literature is to pick one of those things as the risk-free interest rate. And usually it's one of the interest rates on a U.S. government bond. Okay, so Jed is now saying, which maturity would you use? Because those different terminologies, the U.S. Treasury bill is very short term. I think it's like up to 3 months. And then a note is more medium term. I'm not 100%. I think it's like 6 months to a year. And then Treasury bond is longer term. Okay, so those distinctions between a Treasury bill, Treasury note, and Treasury bond have to do with the length of the maturity of the loan. So if it's a very long-term loan, that's a treasury bond. And you may just hear people abbreviate and call it T, so like a T-bill or a T-note or a T-bond. All right, so what I would say, Jed, I guess I don't know for sure that I've seen people do this, but my guess would be you would use the interest rate that's appropriate to the length of the project you're considering. And so if you're considering, you're an investor and you're looking at a project that's going to last 30 years, that's the time horizon you're using, and you're going to calculate like the internal rate of return on that investment over a 30-year horizon, then I think you would compare that to the benchmark of, well, what if I invested in a 30-year treasury bond? What's the rate of return the U.S. government would pay me on a 30-year investment compared to if I'm going to put my money into a 30-year private investment. A couple of caveats. In general, in the real world, there's very few things that are so constitute such a straitjacket where you put all your money in on day one and then you just get a lump sum out 30 years later and then you just calculate the rate of return for the whole period. That's not how many business operations work. Usually, the first upfront period, you're pumping in way more money than you're taking out for those periods of net cash flow in or negative cash flow. And then at some point it flips where even though you might be plowing money back into the business, you start earning more in revenue. And so those periods are net cash flow positive. And then, usually that would grow over time. And so, but there could be, maybe 8 years into it, you got to make another capital expenditure because a lot of the equipment wears out, you got to replace it. So, so there could be all kinds of strange cash flows. And, maybe you as an investor are taking distributions out periodically. Who knows? So it's what I would say is I think the proper benchmark to use would be to get your best assessment of if I were going to try to mimic these same cash flows, just using the proper maturities of bonds issued by the federal government, then, what would my rate of return look like and how would I do with that strategy versus this particular investment project that I'm contemplating? So having said all that, one thing that's interesting is a lot of people are worried that, you know, what would happen if all of a sudden the U.S. government defaults, and beyond any other issues that they might worry about, they're thinking, well, how would the international bond markets work? How would the financial sector work? All of our models are predicated on the U.S. The yield on U.S. Treasury being risk-free. And so that would kind of – and this came up when I can't remember if it was Moody's or Standard & Poor's, but one of those bond agencies, when they downgraded U.S. sovereign debt a few summers ago. And that was one of the issues people brought up. They were saying, you know, not only is this a big deal that if it causes yields to rise, it makes it more expensive for the U.S. government to service its debt, but, oh, my goodness, this is kind of really throwing a monkey wrench into all the mathematical models that people on Wall Street and other financial hubs use, because they treat U.S. government debt as if it's risk-free. I mean, we've always kind of known that it really wasn't, but gee whiz, what happens if the U.S. debt gets downgraded? Then we have no thing as a risk-free asset. So on the one hand, I think that's probably good that people get shaken out of their comfort zone and realize it's kind of crazy to be calling U.S. government debt risk-free. Okay. Let's see. Oh, let me say one last thing on that debt. That's such a great question. There's all sorts of ways to take it. The other thing is, up till now, I've been speaking as if you don't need to worry about the different levels of risk inherent in an enterprise, or Ludwig von Mises would probably be more likely to say the degree of uncertainty. Because, again, that word risk for Mises means a very quantifiable thing. And if we're talking about the success of an entrepreneurial venture, it's really misleading to say, oh, there's a 12% of failure there, and over here, this venture only has an 8% probability of default. That you're fooling yourself if you put such specific numbers on things, because you really don't know. But nonetheless, it is true that there are different degrees of uncertainty with various enterprises, and so you have to take that into account. And that's why, for example, so it's not enough. The example that I use all the time to say, suppose you're an investor considering a long-term investment in an apartment complex, and it's going to cost you $1 million up front. You're going to, you know, buy the plot of land, pay people to erect the building and so on, and then going forward, maybe you're going to make $80,000 in net income. You know, your tenants are going to pay you rent after you pay the property taxes and blah, blah, blah. You're going to have $80,000 free and clear that you're going to clear from that enterprise above and beyond the cost of maintenance and what have you. And so you say, okay, I'm earning 8% on my money, on my capital, more accurately, in that project. And then what if I tell you, oh, yeah, the market interest rate on very safe corporate bonds is 5%. And so from what I've said up till now, you might be tempted to say, oh, so the economic profit there is 3% on that apartment project, because you're earning 8% on your investment there, but you can only earn 5% with investing in these safe corporate bonds. And it's not necessarily true, because investing in the apartment complex carries with it a much greater possibility of the whole thing blown up in your face, as opposed to you lending money, especially to a very reputable, solid company. So it's not necessarily the case that you, and especially as that margin shrinks, it's not necessarily true that it would be a good idea for you to invest your $1 million in this apartment complex if it's going to yield you 8%. If you could instead take that $1 million and buy AAA corporate bonds that yield 7.8%. You know what I'm saying? That investing in something that gives a comparable rate of interest that's a lot safer might make a lot more sense. And so the So that's just another element in all this. When you're trying to take some of this textbook theory that I'm giving you and then apply it in the real world, things get more complicated. Okay, Jed says, in lecture two, I think you said private property alone is not sufficient for a market economy and that money is also required and that Mises emphasized this point. Isn't a direct exchange economy also a market economy despite its limitations? I don't remember exactly what I said, Jed. For sure, what is true is that Ludwig von Mises claimed, and I agree with him, that in order to get the full benefits of the market economy, you need to be able, you need economic calculation, and that you can't have economic calculation without money prices. So if you're asking me, well, if you had a direct exchange economy that had private property, but they hadn't yet developed money, would Mises consider that to be a market economy? I don't remember him ever actually saying so definitively. It wouldn't surprise me if he did. I mean, he wouldn't have said it that way, but the way he might have come out is if he said something like, you know, the market economy does not realize its full potential or does not provide its true harvest of humanity except with the manifestation of market or money prices. I'm obviously not giving you an actual quote. I'm just trying to show that sort of language he might have used. But it's an interesting theoretical point, Martin, or Jed, I should say. Switched to your last name. But part of my answer is going to be you wouldn't for very long see a society that had private property and that we would consider to be a market economy, and yet the people didn't develop money. And that's, I don't know if I mentioned this during the lecture, but that was part of my response to this guy, Jonathan Graeber. Wait, it might be David Graeber. Hang on, let me check. Yes, David Graeber, excuse me. So he has a book on debt, and that in this book, he goes through the archaeological and sociological literature and argues that, or an anthropological, that would be the other field of study, and says that, hey, these economists in the Mengerian and Adam Smith tradition are just crazy. They're just inventing fairy tales. They have this idea that there were these primitive people that first engaged in barter exchange, then they realized the limitations, and they developed money out of that. And he said the historical record doesn't show that. We don't have any evidence. We don't have, archaeological digs don't show evidence of a community. We don't have transactions from merchants, blah, blah, blah. We don't have any evidence of communities who were engaged in this sort of market before the emergence of money. And so Graeber thinks he's blown up our whole story that, you know, Menger and Mises would have told. But my response was to say, well, no, if you take their story at face value, it would have been a very quick development. And we have a historical documented example of this with the POWs in the World War II camps. That famous article, I think it's called like the Economics of a POW Camp, something like that. But a guy, there was an economist, a trained economist, who was in the armed forces, I think for like the British Air Force or something, I can't remember. And anyway, he gets captured by, I think, the Germans, and he's in their POW camp during World War II, and they started using cigarettes as money. And so, like, at the, you know, because they were getting care packages from the Red Cross. So everybody during the, when they would get these standard allocations that the prisoners would receive, you know, they would have rations of food and whatever, treats. And then everybody would get, like, two cigarettes or something. I'm making that up. But everybody would get two cigarettes. And so that quickly became the commodity that everyone used as money. And, you know, it was, it's a fascinating article, and it turned into, you know, after a while, like, even though they would quote it in terms of cigarettes, like that was the unit of account, really what that meant was, the amount of tobacco that would be in the standard cigarette. And so, like, if somebody tried to buy something with a really, you know, messed up cigarette that was all worn away, and actually they would just open it up and dump the tobacco out and see, well, how much tobacco is in this compared to how much would be in a regular cigarette. So then you'd get dinged because it wasn't a full body cigarette. Okay, so, and they would, when I say it was money, I mean literally it was money. That they would have like blackboards where they would have markets and the prisoners would exchange stuff. You know, somebody got some kind of meat and he was a vegetarian, he would go and try to trade that away for somebody's apple. And of course, the prisoners who didn't smoke, obviously they would have smoked cigarettes, but they were still valuable to them. They would use them and trade away for other stuff. Okay, so it was a commodity money, and they had records and stuff, and you could see the workings of Gresham's Law and all kinds of other neat things, that when the care packages would come in, you could see the prices fluctuate, and then over time, you know, as people were smoking away the cigarettes, then maybe prices quoted in terms of cigarettes would go down and that sort of stuff. And, but my point to Graber was, if besides, you know, we had that guy's firsthand account, and he explained to us how it happened and how it evolved. But if we just had archaeologists who stumbled upon the ruins of the POW camp, you know, they would find a blackboard that had maybe, you know, quotes in terms of cigarette prices or things like that. And, you know, you wouldn't necessarily see evidence of the period of maybe just a day or two before the prisoners started using the cigarettes as money. It happened pretty fast. That they could obviously, you know, see what the problems were with barter, and then it wouldn't take long for somebody who wasn't a smoker, you know, so a prisoner gets the care package that's got the cigarettes in it, and he's not a smoker, but he can see other people are smokers, and they really like those cigarettes. And so he's not going to be an idiot and throw his cigarettes out. And he's not going to he's probably not just going to be a nice guy and give them to people. He's probably going to realize, well, wait a minute, these things are valuable. Let me start offering. So it wouldn't take very long at all for everybody to realize that, oh, I can trade, you know, the things I don't want, I can just get rid of them and get cigarettes and then use the cigarettes to go get whatever I want, because I know I'm not going to have a problem finding somebody who wants cigarettes. And so those quickly became the most marketable commodity. And if you think through it, it's for all the reasons we talked about why gold and silver were such good monies. That with what they had to work with in that POW camp, the cigarettes were pretty versatile, or I should say pretty durable, and homogeneous. Because like I said, they started using the tobacco, and that was the actual, you know, the weight of tobacco. That was the issue. That was the actual unit of money. And I guess they were pretty good in terms of their value, the weight relative to other things. That, you know, you wouldn't need 60 pounds of tobacco in order to get a can of tuna fish or something. And so all the various – and they were very marketable initially. And so it wasn't hard for that market to take off. So anyway – that was just a long way of me coming around, Jed, saying that when you understand the logic of the Mengarian explanation for how a society that has private property and people understand how they can trade with each other, so you have direct exchange, once you have that going, it would be very quick. I mean, it would almost be instant. Let me put it this way. It's almost impossible to imagine a large group of people just engaging in direct exchange. It's almost immediate that they would switch to indirect exchange, where somebody accepts something, not because he wants to use it, just because he realizes this is my ticket, this is my gateway to what I want. This is more marketable than the thing I just gave up. Right? So that would happen almost immediately. And that is just an empirical question of once people start accepting good, this media of exchange, how long does it take before at least one of those goods ends up being accepted by everybody? Because then at that point, you're in a full-blown money economy. So that's, I guess I'm sort of dodging your question, Jed, that I cannot definitively tell you whether Mises would say yes or no, the market economy requires money. I think he would say the market economy requires money because he says in several places it's based on economic calculation and that you need to have that, you need to have money. But as far as, you know, so does that mean if you caught them and said, okay, Mises, point blank, suppose there were a group of people that had private property but were not using money, what do you say? Is that a market or isn't it? Is that a market economy or isn't it? I'm not 100% sure what he would say, but I think he would argue the question, though perhaps interesting from a pedantic point of view, just to get our terminology straight, it's a little practical significance because anybody that did get to that position would soon develop money. Okay, do you have any other questions, folks who are logged in? These are all really good questions, Jed. Okay, Jed says, do you anticipate teaching Man Economy and State live again to the Mises Academy? I know it's available for independent study in three parts already. So, again, just to elaborate on what Jed's asking everybody, in the past, I went through Man Economy and State in three different courses. Right? Just as we're now in three courses going through lessons for Man Economy, we did something comparable for Man Economy and State a while back. And with all the Mises Academy courses, you're able to, I think it's for a lower price, I'm not sure, go back and buy access to the recording and that sort of thing. So Jed's asking, in the future, am I ever going to come back and do that again live? I don't know, Jed. I would be happy to do it. With a lot of these things, it just depends on our – yeah, I talked with Danny Sanchez, who's kind of the point man at the Mises Institute for Mises Academy, and it's partly my schedule too. Like I have a ton of stuff going on that I just can't teach a class because, you know, it's not fair to you guys if I'm not able to keep up with it. And so then if I do know I'm going to have an opening in my schedule, then I'll check into Danny and say, hey, what looks like a good thing to offer now? So, with the Man Economy and State, I'm not sure, just to be honest with you, I don't know. I would certainly be happy to do it. It's just partly a function of we don't want to do it too soon after doing something similar because then we might not get the enrollment to make it worth everybody's time to do the thing. So it might make sense actually to do it since I have a bunch of you guys going through Lessons for the Young Economist, and it kind of would make sense that after you've worked methodically through Lessons in the Economy, you've got all the tools you need to jump into Man Economy and State and then, you know, take it to the next level. So maybe after, you know, so there's this course, then of course the next thing I'm going to do is the third installment of this series where we finish out Lessons for the Young Economist, and then, you know, there'd be a break, and then conceivably the next one to do would be going through Man Economy and State. So I don't know if you're asking me, you know, like if you're ready to pull the trigger and start doing independent study, but, you know, if I told you for sure we were doing it in October, then you would wait. I cannot tell you for sure that we're doing it in October. So I don't know what to tell you. It's, I guess I could say I would never want to discourage someone from independently jumping in and starting to study in Man Economy and State, but I wouldn't want to hold you back on the off chance that we're going to offer it live in the near future. also for Jed and everyone else who's either tuned in or is hearing this later as a recording, if you ever have suggestions for courses you would want either me or other Mises faculty to teach, by all means, go ahead and send either Danny Sanchez an email or send it to me. That's like I say, this is, I mean, you guys can figure out the economics of it. The more people we get signed up for a course, the more worthwhile it is for us to go ahead and prepare it and offer it. So that's part of the entrepreneurial component in what we do on our end. We've got to offer something that we think a lot of people are going to want to sign up for. So when Obamacare was huge a few months ago, I said, hey, do we have someone teaching that? They didn't. And so that's why I said, okay, well, I'll get a quick one on that, just because that was such a huge deal. And a lot of people didn't want to get a quick crash course in it. Any other questions from the people logged in live? Okay, while you guys are thinking, let me mention something briefly. Somebody brought up a good point regarding lecture, what would it be, 5, the one on supply and demand. And when this also is right in your textbook, it was the first example that we worked through where, you know, after I told you how demand worked and how supply worked and combined them to get the market clearing price and quantity, and then the first real example we worked with to show you how do you use these things in practice, I said something like, suppose the OPEC countries announce they're going to reduce the amount of oil they're pumping, how would you use supply and demand curve to illustrate this? And what I was trying to get you to do with that example was to shift the supply curve to the left. And I think probably 99% of all professional economists in terms of an introductory class, if they saw that question, they would know that, of course, that's what I had in mind. But somebody on my blog, when I posted that lecture on there, somebody brought up this question, and the person was right. He said, well, wait a minute. Really, all you're hearing, all you know from the announcement is that OPEC is changing the number of barrels that they're actually pumping, right? So they're actually not announcing to the world that, hey, at every possible hypothetical world price of oil, we're not going to pump fewer barrels than we would have in the alternate universe that we're never going to see now. And so the person's saying, you know, what if instead you had your original supply and demand curve for oil, and then maybe the demand changed? Like, what if the demand shifted left? And so you would see the quantity of oil pumped, you know, the quantity of oil being pumped would also fall. And so couldn't that be consistent with the OPEC announcement? So the point was, this guy was getting at the question asking, how do you know that the announcement is the cause of a change? What if the announcement is the reaction to something else that changed? Right. So it's a fair question, and the person is right. I'm sort of supplementing the point. Obviously, in a comment on a blog post, he's not going to get real technical and write paragraphs. But for sure, it is true that all you would know from an OPEC announcement is what they're saying. And all you would really, the only data points you would actually have are the original amount being produced and then the new amount being produced. And so why are you interpreting it as a shift in the whole supply curve itself? The technical could be something else. Yeah, that's true. You can never see a curve itself moving. But what I would say is one way to defend what I was talking about is that we kind of had an assumption that there was this stable price, and then all of a sudden OPEC makes the announcement and the price changes. Okay, so if it really were the kind of story that the guy in the blog post brought up, where he said, suppose you had your original equilibrium And then for whatever reason, world demand for oil drops. So that shifts the demand curve left. And then we would just be moving along the supply curve and they would be restricting output. And so wouldn't, you know, couldn't that be explained by OPEC's announcement? Okay. But then even there, what you would see is the world price of oil would be falling. And then OPEC would say, you know, we sense weakness in the oil market, and so we're cutting back production. Okay, so that's, anyway, I suppose you could say that story I just told you there is consistent with the original story I had in the textbook. So the important thing is obviously not what happens in some hypothetical OPEC story. The important thing is that you understand the distinction between a move in supply versus a move in demand, in a movement of a curve versus movement along the curve. That, I mean, that's really what I want you to get you to see. But it is true that I thought it was obvious that if OPEC says we're cutting production, that was a shift in supply. But as this guy pointed out, strictly speaking, you might want to get more information. And that it's, if I'm telling you, oh, the price was actually falling, and then OPEC says we're cutting the amount of oil we're bringing to market, well, you could plausibly interpret that as them moving along our supply curve, that really the price was falling because demand shifted left. So you could, and that's actually true. You could see examples of that in the real world where because of a recession or something, or maybe with the boom in fracking and horizontal drilling and everything with the natural gas market, I mean, if for some reason the world demand for oil either drops in absolute value, or to get more sophisticated on you, if it doesn't rise as much as people thought it was going to rise, then what that means is the price of oil is not as high as OPEC may have thought it was going to be when they were setting up their original production timetables. And so then they might reduce, you know, they might announce to the world, oh, we're cutting back. And they might, again, they might even say, because we perceive weakness in the oil market. That's the kind of language they use. Or the oil market seems soft. And so we're going to, you know, not sell as much into the market, try to pull back. So it's, with all this stuff, I mean, the oil market's very interesting. There's a lot of cool things that economists do when studying it, because, you know, the oil, it's pretty different from like the orange market, right? The market for oranges, there's so many oranges that grow each year or each harvest, and you got to use them pretty soon or else they go bad. But with oil, it's not like that at all. With oil, certainly if you just limit your attention to conventional oil, you know, not like the stuff with shale oil and that kind of stuff, but just conventional oil that we're used to thinking of, there's pretty much a fixed amount on planet Earth right now, or within planet Earth. And if you don't use it this year, you can just use it later. So it's almost the opposite of something like the market for apples or oranges. And so the economic analysis of it is a lot different. You know, with oranges, we can say, oh, there's really good weather and there's a bigger crop this year. Well, that means producers are going to be trying to unload more oranges this year. And so the price is going to have to drop to induce consumers to want to buy that many more, blah, blah, blah. But with oil, it's not like that. If the demand drops, I mean, it's a lot easier for them to say, you know what, let's stop selling today at these high prices. Let's pull back production, and we'll just hold the oil off the market until the future, and we'll sell down the road. All right, so that on the producer side, there's a lot more leeway to the timing of it. But on the other hand, they can't just produce more in an absolute sense. There's only so much oil to work with. So it's, as I say, the oil market is really interesting. And a lot of it has to do with, you can't just do a static analysis of a particular period of time, because actually what the oil producers do is they look into the future and they forecast, what do we think the spot price of oil is going to be in the future? And that influences how much they're going to pump today. It's not just what's the price of oil today, should we pump more or fewer barrels? well, it is that, but the way they make those assessments is they partially have to consider, if we don't sell a barrel of oil today, we can leave it in the ground and then sell it down the road. And so, whereas with oranges, you don't have that luxury. You can sell oranges today or not. And if you don't sell them today, they're going to go bad. Okay, we've got about 5 more minutes. You guys have any other questions? Okay, I can just go for a few more minutes here and then I'll let you guys go a few minutes early. One last thing I'll talk about is I really do encourage you to learn how to graph supply and demand curves and to really understand what they mean. And I'm hoping that that chapter was so elementary and trivial that you're almost like flipping through it, like, what the heck is this? When do we get to the hard stuff? I would rather that you do that than be baffled by it and not really understand it. So make sure you, like, little things like when I say moving a supply curve to the right, and I'm going to now tell you, you're not moving a curve really. What that means is the underlying preferences have changed because of some change in information or just some other change in the system. And so it's, if we were to redo the supply schedule, you know, that table listing everything, hypothetical prices and then the corresponding quantities of supply, and then we were to regraph the curve based on those new numbers, the resulting curve would be to the right of where we drew it originally. And so that's what we mean metaphorically when we say supply shifted to the right. So again, for those of you who are mathematically savvy, this is going to seem silly to you. Like, well, yeah, who the heck doesn't know that? You're just telling us we need to graph something. But I want to make sure people understand what it means when we say things in loose shorthand of, oh, supply shifted to the right, the demand shifted to the left, that sort of thing. And part of why it's really good to know this stuff is it helps you quickly picture a more complex situation. And so, for example, there was recently something on EconLog, the website where there's David Henderson and Brian Kaplan are like the heavy hitters who've been there for a while. Now they have Scott Sumner who joined them, and then, a new guy, his name escapes me at the moment because he's fairly new. And anyway, I think it was a new guy recently. He had a post talking about some new study that claimed that in, I think it's India, they recently, or not recently, but the study is recent, they looked at the effects of a ban on child labor. And the study was arguing that perversely, when the government tried to crack down on employers and say, we will fine you if we catch you hiring children who are under 14 years old, perversely, that led to more children who were under 14 working. And the mechanism that the authors of the study cited was to say, well, now that when the government comes in and levies this penalty, what does that do? That reduces the employer's demand for child labor. So the demand curve for child labor shifts to the left. And so normally you would think that would reduce the quantity of child labor that was purchased, right? But what is weird is that what if the families who have kids that are young and are sending them to work, you know, if the demand for their labor goes down, clearly what happens is their wage falls, right? Because the wage is like the price in a market for unskilled or child labor. So if the demand falls because of this new government penalty, that means the children who still are working, and, you know, they're doing it illegally, but the point is the government can't perfectly enforce the rule. If you get caught, you get fined. So maybe a lot of employers still kind of do it and try to hide it. But the amount they're going to pay to these kids who are 12 years old is going to be lower now than it was before, because now it's risky. Now what they're doing is illegal and the employer can get caught. So they're going to be willing to pay less in order for them to still be willing to do it, because now it's riskier from their point of view as the employer. So these kids are now getting paid less. So the point was, if you were the kind of family before that would send your 12-year-old to work, and now the 12-year-old's getting less money, that might not make you say, oh, okay, well, my 12-year-old can now just stay home and play all day or go to school. No, you might say, well, shoot, I'm going to send my 11-year-old daughter to the office too, or to the factory too, because now the 12-year-old brother's not bringing home enough money. Okay, so that was the thing. So just to give you, to cut to the chase, something about that story doesn't make sense to me, because the way they're talking about it, it's like the families are going to end up earning more total wages in the new equilibrium, which makes no sense to me. Okay, I could see you sending more kids, but I can't see that you would send more kids such that you end up bringing home more money. But in any event, I was having trouble just picturing that, and then finally I worked out, with the help of some people in my comments in my blog, the way you'd have to draw a funky looking supply curve. So from your guys' point of view, it would look like that. And so the way to draw the supply curve, that for a certain region of the supply curve, it actually would be backward bending, is the way they call it. So first it's upward sloping, then it flips and goes the other way, and then it flips again. And then, you know, I was wondering, can I draw a demand curve that looks normal and shift it to the left and end up having a lower wage and more quantity of labor supplied? And the answer is yes, if you draw the supply curve in this funky way. So anyway, point is just, you end up using supply and demand, even if you're a professional economist, is just a quick way to help you think through an issue coherently. Okay, well, we're over time. I will stop there, guys. Thanks for tuning in. And I will send out a separate email blast soon about your quizzes for weeks 5 and 6. Thanks.